Hello, I'm Richard Penson, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for today's podcast entitled Up for Debate: Effective First Line Maintenance Strategies for Advanced Ovarian Cancer. Today's program is supported by a joint educational grant from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals and Merck Sharp and Dohme Corp, a subsidiary of Merck and Company Incorporated. Again, I'm Richard Penson, a physician at Mass General Brigham and an associate professor of Harvard Medical School, and also the IRB chair at the Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer Center in Boston. Dr. Moore is a fabulous colleague of mine. She's professor of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology in the section of gynecologic oncology at the University of Oklahoma College of Medicine and deputy director of the Stevenson Cancer Center, Oklahoma City. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here talking about PARP inhibitors.
PARP inhibitors. Before we begin, we'd like to repeat our learning objective, which is to evaluate recent and emerging data for first-line maintenance therapy of advanced ovarian cancer to best inform optimal therapeutic strategies. So, Katie, we have a number of maintenance regimens for women with ovarian cancer, and the specifics depend on the primary therapy. What are your thoughts, your plans for treatment? How are you thinking ahead about maintenance? And give us a little background about how the SOLO 1 study came to be and the immediate history.
That's a lot of questions in one question. So I'm going to break it down. I do think, and I've said this often when I speak, I was a fellow in 2003, 2004, and here we are in 2024. So 20 years, I've been around 20 years.
Yeah.
I've aged myself just now. But a lot has changed. And I think in the past, and I remember this because I lived this, we would have new ovarian cancer diagnosis. We would try and operate on everyone. And that has definitely changed over time. And then we gave paclitaxel and carboplatin for 6 to 8 cycles. And then we, if we didn't have a clinical trial, we waited. We followed patients closely and we took care of them, but we expected they would recur. And we sort of figured it out once they recurred. And I really feel like that mindset has changed dramatically. Like, you're really thinking when you have that first diagnosis, you're already thinking longitudinally over time about what you need to know and how quickly you need to know it to really make sure that patient is getting the right therapies at the right time. And so that really is focused mostly on appropriate genetic testing, genetic or molecular. And we can talk about the sequence with which you kind of try to assess whether or not a patient has BRCA1, BRCA2, or any of the other high penetrance genes, which makes them vulnerable to getting ovarian cancer, but also makes their ovarian cancer vulnerable to some of our therapeutics. So that has really become sort of front and center. Like, you are testing patients as soon as they've kind of gotten over the initial shock of the diagnosis, which is not a small thing. So you can really try and line up what you're going to use in the maintenance. So it's not a, in my mind, it's not a if maintenance, it's a what maintenance
right.
am I going to use? And that can change a little bit over the trajectory of treatment. We can talk about that. But is it a PARP 100% or pretty close, or maybe PARP's on the menu, but we can maybe think about bevacizumab, as options, really kind of starts to filter out as we know if someone has that BRCA1 or 2 or RAD51C, et cetera, if their HRD test positive, and if their HRD test unknown or negative. Mm. You start to figure that out during the course of someone's therapy. And really thinking about, in certain populations, for the first time ever, cure. Like, who am I really going for it? And I think SOLO-1, and we can talk about that next, has shown us we are, in fact, curing. I think we can say that. It's not quite definitive yet, but I do think if we have patients 7 years out without recurrence, the vast majority of them are going to be cured. So I do think we're curing more patients, likely biomarker selected.
Yeah.
You got to know this stuff up front. I think that's what's changed.
When you see a patient, exactly as you say, histology, stage, operability, do you have it in your mind if they have stage 4 disease or serous effusions, a sort of a different strategy to the patient who has optimally cytoreducible HRD negative, HRD positive, or, a highly penetrant HRD gene? Do you approach it differently?
I approach it differently, but it's more than just the kind of stage. It's also some incorporation of response to chemotherapy. So I think we're getting better at identifying patients whose tumors are telling us they're more aggressive.
Yeah.
And that's likely stage. And so when we do have the true stage four disease, we do know that that does identify a group at higher risk for not being cured and maybe earlier recurrences. I think we're getting better, although these aren't validated biomarkers, but you know, the chemo response score for some of our patients that undergo interval cytoreduction is one biomarker. The KLM score with CA125, another biomarker. Of course, fortunately, none of them have been validated, but we all can use them to help us in addition to stage. And I'm just talking about high-grade serous and kind of endometrioid here. Clear cell and mucin is its own separate consideration. You know, so, those are the patients where I'm thinking about maybe adding bevacizumab in if I haven't already. And I'm more worried, honestly, about sort of how I'm going to optimize outcomes for that patient.
So the patient who presents to us nowadays, 40% are going to get neoadjuvant chemotherapy and surgery. And so a full 10%, we actually don't have HRD assays on because there's too little tissue at the time of their surgery. So the clinical response, these other predictive markers, really helpful in choosing who should get a PARP inhibitor switch maintenance. So tell us about SOLO-1.
Sure. So SOLO-1 was, I had the privilege of leading this with Dr. Paul DiSilvestro. And it may surprise some people, but this is the first incorporation of PARP inhibitor in the frontline setting, you know, of the many trials that have now been done. And it started in 2013, just took a long time to result, which usually tells us appropriately that patients were doing well. So it started in 2013, accrued very quickly, 2013, 2014, and we didn't get a readout until 2018. And even then we had to adjust the statistical analysis plan because patients were doing so well. So we could release some of the results. But this was a phase three clinical trial and enrolled patients who had BRCA1 or 2 associated ovarian cancer. 99% of them were germline because if you remember, we weren't testing for somatic BRCA at that point. Two patients actually snuck on probably from your site because someone was being forward thinking and did it, but everyone else had germline. This is really a germline study. They had advanced disease. So they were stage 3 and stage 4. They had received chemotherapy with platinum-based chemotherapy plus a surgery and were in response to that chemotherapy. Randomized then 2-to-1 to 2 years of olaparib or placebo. And the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. There were a number of secondary endpoints that we've reported out over the years, inclusive of overall survival, which is not quite mature yet, but we've given some hints about that. So the results in 2018 were with 41 months of follow-up, and we demonstrated a 70% reduction in the hazard of progression, so a hazard ratio of 0.3 at that time. And importantly, I wish, I think you'll be able to see a slide in the files that come with this podcast. But the one of the most striking things other than a 70% reduction, which was incredibly striking, is that the treatment stopped at 2 years. And so we're kind of median 41 months out and the curves were absolutely plateauing. They were not coming back together in that kind of banana sign we talk about with bevacizumab, where you withdraw the bevacizumab and the curves come back together. These curves were staying separate and kind of cruising along. We updated the data. My colleague, Susanna Banerjee, updated the progression-free survival at 60 months. And they were still kind of just cruising along. And at 60 months, we had about 20% of the patients randomized to placebo had not occurred versus 48% on the olaparib arm. And then we updated that again at 8 years. And we're sitting right about 45% versus 20% not recurred at 8 years. 7 years, pardon me, 7 years. And so the cure rate with chemo alone in this particular population is about 20%. 20% do not need PARP. I would like to know if we can identify who they are and we can de-escalate, but we cannot do that yet. And we rescue about 25% more into that cure fraction with appropriate use of olaparib in the setting. And so I think that is the first glimmer of OS improvement, not just OS, but progression-free survival.
And Glimmer, because it's anticipated to be confirmed as statistically significant. I think that 7-year analysis, it's amazing. You spend the alpha and you're like, oh, you can't show it statistically significant, but it's a massive improvement.
It was a massive difference, but
Rich, it's really exciting.
Yeah. We may never show it. I think the reality is, you know, we're now on the part of the curve where, you know, patients are, may just pass away from natural causes, you know, at some point. And so we may never hit the prescribed number of events, deaths from cancer. And so we're going to have to call it, you know, at some point, 10 years, maybe. We're getting there, but it's a good problem to have.
Yes.
Yeah.
So given that the HRD assays are so helpful and separate patients out into the group with a highly penetrant gene mutation, half the high-grade serous with a HRD positive tumor and half without, how do you go about structuring your treatment choice based on that?
The HRD tests that are available, and there's many, it's so confusing. There's two FDA-approved tests, as you know, one's Myriad MyChoice and the other is the Foundation One. They've both been used, more so the Myriad test, but the recent Athena study used the Foundation test, and they're not the same test. There is overlap, but they've been fairly consistent in identifying, of course, the BRCA tumors are filtered out there. This 20-ish percent who are BRCA wild-type HRD do appear to benefit more. Hazard ratio is about 0.5. In that group. Now, they're all subset analyses, this BRCA wild type HRD, except for Duo, which we'll talk about in a moment. But they're pretty consistent. So hazard ratio of 0.5 in ovarian cancer in frontline is not too shabby. And so I think that's a nice signal. And then in this HRD test negative or unknown, so the studies, you have to look to see if they've just separated the test negative or they've lumped them with the unknown, because those are different populations. We've seen various outcomes in Paola, where you had olaparib bevacizumab versus bevacizumab, subset analysis, not statistically significant signal finding, there's no difference. But yet in Prima, niraparib, again, subset analyses, Athena, subset analyses, they both had very consistent hazard ratios that were like a 35-ish percent reduction in the hazard of progression, which is modest, but it's not zero. So I think when you know that information, as you said, sometimes you don't, but if you know that information, it does allow you to counsel a patient as towards kind of the expectations of how much they will benefit from a PARP inhibitor or not. It may play into your decision to use bevacizumab, either with PARP inhibitor or instead of PARP inhibitor, especially in an HRD test negative population. And so I think it's helpful. But it doesn't tell you, we all hoped it would tell us, this patient population should get PARP, and this patient population does not benefit from PARP, so let's focus on creating new medicines to help this patient population do better, and it just didn't. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we have these all-comers indications, at least for niraparib, and we'll see what happens with Athena, because the rucaparib data is very consistent with Prima. And it is NCCN listed, makes it hard, I think, for providers to sort out, you know, what's the best therapy for some of these patients that are biomarker unknown or negative. It's not clear.
When Paola 1 first came out, I was like superimposing curves and completely convinced that bevacizumab abrogated the benefit in the HRP group. And I have to compliment you that you sound so European, Paola 1. Yeah, that's Paola. I'm a heathen now. tell us about that. So my typical practice is if patients need a PARP inhibitor and they've done really well, benefit in the BRCA mutation carrying patients is really carried by the PARP inhibitor. And so I tend to stop the bevacizumab, which is not associated with improvement in cure. But when Ignace Fogota did that lovely analysis comparing the BRCA mutated tumors between Solo 1 and Paola 1, Paola 1 looked very impressive. What's your take on that, that comparison?
That's such a good question, because that is really one of the important questions is, do you need bevacizumab for BRCA? Do you need it for HRD? And the truth is, we don't know. Fortunately, there are ongoing clinical trials. Right now, Nirvana is one where they're really asking that question, PARP versus PARP Bev. So we'll know, but we won't know for several years, and you've got to make a decision now. And so this is another place of clinical equipoise. And what I basically say is that if you're going to use, based on the current data, if you're going to use bevacizumab for whatever your practices are, some people use it in everyone, some people never use it, some people use it for this high risk, whatever you're doing, we have no data that you should change. So if you're using bevacizumab and you've made that decision with chemotherapy and you've started it and you find out they're HRD or and or BRCA, then you can layer on the PARP inhibitor. I don't tend to stop the bevacizumab. I just tend to layer it on. And of course, if someone's struggling with bevacizumab, which they can, I feel fine about discontinuing it as long as I can keep them on the PARP. And I've certainly, you know, done that. But we just don't have, because of the missing arm in Paula, we just don't have the data we need to say that this population needs both. We have hints from the Verhote analysis and also just from cross-trial comparison, which warning, cross-trial comparison here.
Yeah.
That you can look at Paula and Solo just with the BRCA populations and you say, okay, well, they're both hazard ratio 0.3, so I don't need the bevacizumab, which may be true, actually. Mm-hmm. But it may not be, because Paula is a higher risk, clinical risk population than Solo. Solo was stage 3 and 4. Don't get me wrong. There's no such thing as low risk advanced ovarian cancer. It does not exist. But there are gradations of clinical risk within advanced ovarian cancer. And Solo was on the lower end of that. You know, most of the patients were stage 3. They had, most of them had primary surgery with good outcome, no gross residual. So clinical risk characterized, like, we don't allow those patients on clinical trial anymore because they tend to do well, and we still showed this amazing benefit with Solo One. Paula had more stage 4, more neoadjuvant, and more partial responses, less than Prima. So of the gradation, it's sort of Solo, Paula, Prima, but it is a higher risk. So did the Bev, you know, equalize that risk, or do you not need Bev? We just don't know.
Yeah.
So I just don't think we can make definitive statements to anyone about needing Bev. And I feel like people need to practice as they practice. In biomarker positive, more important thing to me is the PARP is important. The Bev, I don't know if it's essential yet. So I'm, you know, I can't beat someone up for not using it or using it until these studies read out.
Right. And to give Ignace's his dues, they did a correction for eligibility and still found that sort of effect. But we had now, diving down onto very specific subsets. And it's really, as you say, impossible to do the cross-trial comparison.
You just have to be careful with over-interpreting subsets and non-analytic subsets. You know, we really get into trouble when we sort of, but we do it all the time, of course, but... Mm-hmm. You make things dogma that were never meant to be analytic.
Yeah. So you were one of the leaders of the two previously negative immunotherapy trials up front, and then Duo-O gets presented at ASCO. Tell us about Duo-O.
Duo-O, so as you know, we'll talk about this. There's 4 studies that are PARP immunotherapy. I led Imagine 50, which was immunotherapy bevacizumab versus bevacizumab, and that was negative. And then, of course, before that, we had the Javelin study, which was also negative with the Avelumab. But there is this certainly there's preclinical rationale for combining PARP and immune checkpoint inhibitors, a variety of things. At some level, we thought maybe the PARP would increase release of neoantigens. I think we don't really believe that as a rationale anymore, but this idea that the cytosolic DNA that happens when you have DNA damage, activating the STING pathway, and then maybe making this tumor more susceptible to immune checkpoint inhibitors, maybe still holds, although we'll have to see. So it certainly hasn't borne out in the recurrent setting. I think just a lot of negative trials. So I think a lot of these frontline studies were designed with actually scientific rationale, but we're all a little worried about them, but we'll see. Duo-O was the first to report. It was led by Philip Harder and Carol Adjanian, who are both of our good friends and incredibly smart. And I think if they were sitting here, they would say, I would have designed that clinical trial differently than I did, because we all, you know, second guess ourselves. But Duo has a missing arm. And the missing arm, of course, is the olaparib bevacizumab arm. So just to remind the audience, in case they don't know, Duo's frontline, BRCA wild type only. So that's an important thing to remember when you're looking at the Duo curves. This is the first clinical trial to read out that excluded, there's a separate little single arm cohort for BRCA that we haven't seen yet, but the randomization was just BRCA wild type. So the BRCA wild type HRD population that I'm going to talk about in every other study has been non-analytic, exploratory. Here it is fully analytic for the first time ever. So I do think this is a very important study for that reason. But it took the BRCA wild type and randomized to taxol-carbo-bev, bev maintenance, taxol-carbo-bev, durvalumab, bev durvalumab maintenance, or taxol-carbo-bev, durvalumab, bev durvalumab, olaparib maintenance. And the primary analysis was arm three, the triplet, versus arm one, the singlet of bev. So you can already see the problem, which is how you sort out the relative contribution of durvalumab here. It's three versus one. And that really is all the questions. But this is interesting. So it was positive. It looked first at the HRD positive, BRCA wild type HRD positive, and then the ITT, and both were positive. The hazard ratio for HRD positive, again, I'm gonna just keep reemphasizing BRCA wild type, was 0.49. And so remember when we talked about this in the other studies, I said it was about 0.5 for Paula, which was olaparib bev versus bev in a non-analytic subgroup. You've actually now kind of seen that confirmed here in a BRCA wild type HRD, PARP bev, durva versus bev, hazard ratio is 0.49, very consistent. Is that all PARP or is the durva adding anything? We don't really know. And then, but because it was positive, they were able to roll to the intention to treat analysis of arm three versus arm one. And this was also positive with a hazard ratio of 0.63. And so they did show the data. Dr. Harder showed the data with arm two layered in there, which is just the durva bev. And there's no difference between bev and durva bev, which we knew from Imagine 50. We did a whole phase two study to prove that. And it's been shown here again. So the big question is, you know, is this just confirmation that olaparib bev is better than bev again, or is the durva adding anything? And we cannot answer that from Duo. So I think that's sort of where we stand with this one. I do think it's an important study for the reasons that I brought up. It is a very unique population and fully analytic for this HRD positive BRCA wild type population, which is very important. We've never seen a fully analytic cohort here. But for me, it just tells me I should use PARP here. It doesn't tell me I should use a durva. So I struggle with that. I don't know. What do you think?
So I was really excited about Mediola, which is the three drug combination, and especially in platinum sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer. And so I was a little disappointed it wasn't more of a splash. And I think I'm hoping that when we get the overall survival data, it'll be clear. Does it really do anything? I think we're going to have to wait for that.
Yeah.
Can I ask about sort of patient-specific maintenance therapy? Is there a patient who should not get a PARP inhibitor up front, you know, a optimally cytoreduced HRP patient who's had intraperitoneal treatment or something like that? Is there a patient where you say, you know, you mentioned the 20%. Is there anybody you don't give a PARP inhibitor to?
Yes. And I'm really interested in this question of individualization. I think there's definitely patients that decline, you know, patients that are whose tumors are homologous recombination proficient, like really low MyRisk score or whatever test you use. You know, I kind of tell them what the score is. And we talk about PARP, we talk about bevacizumab, and some of my patients just don't want anything and they just want a break. And they want me to see them in 3 months and they will call me if they have any symptoms. And that's just shared decision making. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I have a patient with BRCA who did not want anything.
Well, I have one. Yes.
Beings. Like they can choose.
Right.
I'm like, every patient should have a PARP if they want. I mean, that's the, you need to offer it. That's your job. But some of my patients just don't want it. And then I have to just follow them, and I worry about them a lot, but you know, I follow them and take good care of them, and we cross bridges as we come to them, but we just don't go back and, like, you know, revisit the past. You just have to move forward. So I do think that's happens.
Yeah, I had a poor 84-year-old who, at the end of her doxil carbo, because she refused to get alopecia, she got C. diff, and it really exploded in Aruba, which she was treating herself to at the end. And she came back and she was like, done. I don't want anything more poisonous. And so we're watching her, as you say, carefully. And she's got a BRCA1 mutation, and, you know, I'm sure I'll get a PARP inhibitor in the future if she has a recurrence.
So at least they're still on label for her. That's the only place in the recurrence.
Yes,
that's important
BRCA,
to say.
Right.
In the recurrent setting, that is the only group who can get PARP in the recurrent setting now.
Briefly tell us why.
I think that justifies using it in everybody in the front line. I'm not that pragmatic, but you do have to think about that.
Yeah, right. So tell us about the length of therapy. You probably have particular insights into how that 2-year duration for olaparib 3 for niraparib was chosen.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of my first big studies that I designed. I was a much younger person then. And I remember sitting there, and there were several people. Mike Bookman was on that committee, many really of our esteemed colleagues. It was a team effort to do solo one. Like, I get credit, but there's a lot of people. And I was like, I want to just use it indefinitely. Like, these are high risk patients, and this is going to work, and I don't ever want to stop the PARP inhibitor. And some people felt that way. Some people didn't. The FDA did not agree with that. They're like, nope, you know, you have to stop. And so ultimately, the 2 year was a little bit arbitrary, but it was mainly kind of covering a couple standard deviations above which the control arm was felt to perform. Which I'm also going to tell you, I thought they were wrong. They predicted 13 months. The statisticians at AstraZeneca predicted that. I'm like, that's way too short. These are all patients with BRCA. They are not, but it was right on. It was exactly what happened. So I was wrong. So you're sometimes you're wrong. And you're right.
That's why we do science. Yeah.
Exactly. That's what you're designed. So that's where the 2 years came from. And so that's really what I hold to. I really don't feel like we should be maintaining patients indefinitely. I've completely done, you know, a 180 on that. If they're in full kind of remission and we're getting better, I think it, you know, do you use ctDNA? I'm not advocating for that because we don't have validation of that yet, but I use it. Makes me feel better to stop somebody, you know, but we need to validate it.
Yeah.
Don't do what I'm doing just because I say.
Right. Yeah. Do what we're testing in trials. Exactly. Yeah,
exactly.
So we only have a couple of minutes. Given that the PARP1 inhibitors may have less heme toxicity, may have less genotoxic effects, maybe the wave of the future. Tell us a little bit about what's to come.
I'm really excited about it's saruparib. I think I'm saying that right. AZD5305. It's saruparib.
Yep.
I actually know the development plan. It's not quite in the public domain, so I can't share it yet, but it is coming. Our really good friend at MD Anderson, Tim Yap, presented at AACR kind of the first signals from that important agent, largely in a PARP pretreated population. You were still seeing less anemia and seeing some responses, which was very surprising. It was phase one data in many solid tumors, but it was that you're like, huh, that's not what I would have expected a PARP monotherapy to do. So we are quite excited about this agent. It is coming forward, and there is a big trial planned that will be announced relatively soon. It's just not quite in public domain yet, but I do think we'll see this in play. As you can imagine, it's a hard space to bring a new PARP into because you go up against some olaparib, which has been curative, you know, in some patient populations. So the population will be quite unique that it's brought forth in. But I do really like this. There's several novel PARP inhibitors coming up that have more tankerase inhibition, you know, PARP1 selective. They're all very interesting. It's just you can imagine it's just an ovary. It's a difficult place to develop because the current PARP inhibitors are actually pretty well tolerated and work pretty well. But when you look at other solid tumors, pancreas, breast, where these studies have been positive, but not as positive, like they're not as overwhelmingly game-changing as they have been in ovary, you may see these come in and work better.
Better. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's time to wrap up our discussion. So let me summarize what we've discussed today. Katie Moore, the PI of Solo One, telling us to test everyone so we really know what we're doing, and about that transforming data that really has got switch maintenance PARP inhibitors up front to improve the chance of cure. Very exciting. You can find additional information and resources at the CME Outfitters Oncology Hub, with a number of excellent resources for both clinicians and patients. And to receive CME CE credit for today's program, complete the post-test and evaluation, and you'll be able to download and print the certificate immediately upon completion. Remember, this is the third of a six-part podcast series on gynecologic cancers. Next month, we'll be joined by Aramaz Askandar and to discuss first-line therapy in the treatment of advanced ovarian cancer with non-mutated BRCA. I hope you'll be able to join us. You can find additional podcasts in this series on the Oncology Hub at cmeoutfitters.com. And again, thank you, Katie. Thank you for joining me for this very important discussion, and thank you to our audience for participating and for providing the best care for patients with ovarian cancer.